Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. In this episode, rocket scientist and aerospace engineer Anita Sengupta is interviewed by editor of 97 Things Every Programmer Should Know, Kevlin Henney. They discuss the developments and use cases for hydrogen-powered aircrafts. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are and whenever you are. My name is Kevlin Henney. I'm here at GoTo Copenhagen. Of particular relevance is timing-wise, we're actually recording this about halfway through the United Nations Climate Change Talks, COP26. And I'm joined by Anita Sengupta, whose CV is ridiculously long and covers quite literally multiple worlds. Possibly the most stable and realistic thing we can talk about is the fact she is a professor of aeronautical engineering at the University of Southern California. But our particular interest here, and for anybody who has an interest in technology and climate, Anita's just spoken about the future of flight and what it means from a broader point of view and in terms of climate change or our effect on the environment. But in particular, can we do better is the short answer. And Anita's track record, as I said, it literally is quite spacey. It starts off with NASA, goes through Hyperloops, and ends up with Hydroplane, which we'll talk about a little bit. Hello, Anita.
Hello, nice to see you. Thank you.
Let's start at the end. Hydroplane, your current work, your startup, is really about electric powered flight. And most people, if they hear that, they go, yeah, the batteries are going to be too heavy. You know, you're never going to get, you know, some people might have a Tesla and they'll go, oh yeah, I mean, it's beautiful, it's silent. But then there's the range issue, then there's the battery size issue. When people think of an aircraft, that's what comes to mind. Big batteries. This is not the future. What is?
So I did spend about 2 years focused on electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, which are intended to be short range and powered by batteries. And that's where I really saw the true challenge of being able to implement energy storage onto aircraft. So batteries don't work if you want to have anything which has a range of more than an hour.
Yeah, which is probably quite a lot of flight.
In Southern California, you would be challenged to fly anywhere and land within an hour just because it's such a busy airspace.
Yeah, so that kind of time range, that gives us drones, basically. We already know that one, don't we? That's, I wouldn't say that's our comfort zone, but that is a, when you say that to somebody, they go, oh, okay, yeah, we do have electric flight, but then it's that short charge thing. So how do we get further? Because fuel consumption, when people look at flight is incredibly energy intensive. The energy densities required, we have the dreams of the past. I still have the books from when I was a kid. We'll have nuclear airplanes, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, that might not be such a hot idea. So how are we going to do this? Also, growing up, there was Solar Challenger, this huge, great glider-like thing with massive solar panels, but light as a feather and clearly utterly impractical, could not scale. How are we going to do this and get beyond drone time?
So the solution, I believe, is hydrogen fuel cells. And so you would actually have onboard fuel, which is your hydrogen, but going through an electrochemical reaction to produce electricity to an electric motor with hydrogen fuel cells.
And they have a really nice long history, don't they? You know, hydrogen fuel cells, they keep popping up. Everybody keeps talking about the hydrogen economy, but they have a really good engineering history in spaceflight.
Yes, they were used on board the space shuttle program. Yeah. As the energy storage means, because of their efficiency per unit mass.
Yeah, so that we've got that. You've got hydrogen, you've got oxygen, and you're going to get some nice energy from that.
And I think, you know, from a regulatory perspective, it's already used ubiquitously in the United States with hydrogen fuel cell-powered cars, for example. So you can design a system which is safe for on-road use, including all the different off-nominal scenarios that you might find that has stored compressed hydrogen on board.
Yeah, so that's going to be, that's one of the obstacles, isn't it? The regulatory, the safety, the regulatory, and so on. And so if you've got a startup that's looking into this space, I guess you're tackling, You're tackling two things, really, aren't you? You're tackling the technology, the feasibility, what I guess anybody who's in technology would call the fun stuff. It's just like, hey, this sounds like a really cool problem to solve. The engineering challenges, the joy of seeing something work, and then there's regulation, which clearly there's a necessity for it, but that's not going to be fun. That's a very different world as well. So does the road, road vehicles that are hydrogen-based, is that kind of clearing the way for you a little bit?
I mean, it certainly helps in the sense that there is government regulation in place for how to design a system from a reliability perspective for ground-based transport, how to design for different load cases, how to do fueling operations, for example. But for aviation, of course, it's always different because you're not on the road, you're in the air. So with a car, you can pull off to the side, but with an aircraft, obviously, you can't do that. So it does change things like reliability requirements, durability requirements, that is an engineering implementation challenge, which you always have to deal with. And I think the bigger issue, though, is if a regulatory agency isn't familiar with the technology, you have to get the agency familiar. So that means FAA and the European equivalent has to become more familiar with the technology so that they can have their own regulatory structure that goes around it. So there is that element of risk. But that also, once again, it's an engineering challenge which can be solved. And it shouldn't stop you from doing what is required to decarbonize aviation.
I think that's a really interesting point about the familiarity, because I mean, people like the FAA have got decades of experience in a very particular, you know, they've seen the field and accompany the field as that's evolved, conventional flight, and here's something new. And of course, there will be some point in the future where they have the same or equivalent comparable expertise in say hydrogen based flight. So you're generating electricity in flight. And during the talk, you showed some images, a light aircraft. And I'm going to say I'm not a pilot, so I don't plane spot. I couldn't sit there and go, oh, that's what's different and so on. To me, that looked like a very conventional light aircraft. There was nothing, you weren't trying to get two things. It's kind of like, here's the method of, you know, we have a method of electric propulsion fueled by hydrogen fuel cells, but the craft itself looked very conventional, very acceptable and unsurprising. And it's only if you pointed at pictures and said, right, that one's hydrogen and the rest are conventional, that people would know. So is that, how much of that is just a byproduct of design, or how much of that is intention?
I would say it's mainly intention. And the reason is that why would you reinvent the wheel if you don't have to? If you have a perfectly good aircraft from a aerodynamic efficiency perspective, why come up with a new one? And when you're trying to develop a new technology, you have to raise a certain amount of capital. So we want to expend all of our capital into the new intellectual property, into the difficult engineering challenge, which is the power plant, and we can reutilize and retrofit existing aircraft.
I presume that would also be useful from a pilot's point of view. If you've got a flying license, then it still handles the same.
Exactly. Yeah. Basically, you just have to be a private pilot to be able to fly these types of aircraft. And then for commercial purposes, you would just have to be a commercial pilot to fly these aircraft for those purposes. And I think it's a really good point with regards to coming up with new platforms, because there's another new sector of advanced air mobility, which is eVTOL, electric vertical takeoff and landing. And those are brand new aircraft, different designs, different flying skills required. In some cases, no one's ever done it before. So that's a huge challenge in and of itself, which adds additional risk to getting those types of technologies implemented. So this one, it's pretty easy to implement as long as you can show that you have the reliability for the power plant as necessary to meet the requirements from the regulatory agency.
So that's quite nice in that sense of kind of like, okay, we're going to innovate along this axis and in this space. Everything else stays kind of constant. That's a little more familiar, which I guess is good from investment, but also from a practical point of view, people aren't thinking, oh, we're going to need all this kind of new infrastructure, retraining and all the rest of it. So what kind of range are you getting on that at the moment?
So we're designing for 1,000 kilometers of range. And so that could meet a whole variety of use cases for small aircraft, whether that's humanitarian aid, disaster relief, any type of governmental use case, cargo, island transport, offshore transport. And also, if you have shorter range, you can have multiple sorties or multiple missions before you have to refuel.
So, yeah, and that will actually get you somewhere in California, distance-wise as well. So that's so how does that compare to the range of a regular light aircraft?
It's the same.
Yeah. That's really cool.
So that was what we designed it for, was to be compatible, because those aircraft already have a set of missions that utilize that endurance, and so we're achieving the same thing.
So you can basically, from a sales pitch point of view, it's like, see this, we're doing the same, but it's greener, there's less impact. You know, we're producing water rather than CO2, and that's a very different story.
Yes.
So that's kind of an interesting, and you mentioned a number of different use cases, and I think that's quite an interesting one, because I think in many people's perspectives, flight means different things to different people. For some people it means holidays. For other people, they see, oh, this is cargo, this is whatever. But you're kind of slicing through the uses and saying, here's where the strength of this lies, that you're not trying to take on all of aviation at once, you're going for particular sectors. It sounds intentional, but is that?
It is. And of course, I am a general aviation pilot. I also do search and rescue flying, mission operations as well. So it's something I'm quite familiar with. And I also wanted to make it more accessible. So people don't realize that general aviation actually is very accessible. Most general aviation pilots are not incredibly wealthy people. They're just regular people who are interested in flying. And there is a movement afoot to provide a more of an air taxi type of scenario, which is the eVTOL use case. Instead of having a brand new aircraft that you have to wait 10 years to get, you can actually fly these as an air taxi and complete that use case. And for me, I was also interested in having a carbon emission free platform for humanitarian aid disaster relief operations to make it accessible to people who really need it.
So that, yeah, and I think you're right, because I do know a friend of mine has just started learning to fly. Another friend of mine who's, is he a week, 2 weeks older than me? He learned when he was 17, 18. I remember because he used to turn up his, most people when they get carded, they pull out their driving license. but Orhan's thing was we get stopped in a pub in London, he'd pull out his flying license, which was so cool. And he was actually, everybody else was actually younger than him in the group. So they thought, oh, well, you got flying license, you guys must all be old. That was a really good trick. But yeah, so there is an accessibility that I think is underestimated.
And there's lots of governmental use cases. So we actually were funded initially by Agility Prime, which is part of the Air Force. And so they see electric flight as something in the future. And they know that in order to achieve the range requirements that they would like to see for their humanitarian aid disaster relief operations, they have to shift over to fuel cells.
So that's a really broad. So there seems to be this kind of, am I using the right metaphor here? Groundswell. We're talking air here, but there's a groundswell right across the board. I mean, that's a lot of different people who are showing real interest, and it seems very feasible. There's something else that I think is also interesting about. You talked about the range, and there was a comment that you made, which I don't think I'd ever thought about. Although in terms of routing, I've seen it come up before in the past. Often when we think in terms of the environmental costs of flight, we tend to think of long-haul international flights. And you made a point that that's actually not where the weight of the environmental damage is being caused.
It actually comes from regional flights, which are shorter range. So if you were, cruising at, let's say, 600 kilometers per hour, right, for a regional flight going from city to city, that's where the bulk of the CO2 output comes. And if you look at the power profile for an aircraft, use your most power during climb. So if you're a short mission, short cruise, you're always using up a lot of power because of that. So if you can address that market, decarbonize that market by going with platforms like twin turboprops, for example, which is much more feasible, then you can actually reduce the CO2 output for the commercial aviation transport sector as a whole.
So that takeoff and landing aspect. It's not the distance in the middle. It's really that those two aspects. That reminds me of the old bulbs, that the greatest costs are turning them on and off. that's when you get a spike in terms of the usage. And it seems to be a similar thing. So clearly there's a lot more, it's the upping and downing rather than the along-ing, if I'm allowed to make those verbs, that really causes the damage there.
Yeah, you're cruising at a lower than 100% power level. I mean, you can choose to cruise at 100%, but most people don't, right? So that's why you can actually reduce your total CO2 output by having a more efficient power plant for these shorter range use cases.
So just thinking in terms from a European perspective, that kind of range and that kind of range and that's a good market, and even within just parts of the regional US.
There's another aspect to this too, which is if you look at developing countries around the world, they oftentimes use much older aircraft, which means that they're less energy efficient. So they have also a larger bulk of the CO2 output because they're using less fuel efficient aircraft to begin with. So if you can bring in these aircraft to these markets to support their regional use case, you can also have a big impact on reducing CO2. But of course, the United States probably still has the biggest one.
Yeah, but for a developing market, the possibility that they could get into something that is cheaper and cheap and clean from the ground level, so that their old craft become the hydrogen craft rather than current generation. That's quite attractive. Allows them to grow a market, but without kind of trampling all over the environment in that way.
Yep, And the other synergy that exists here, too, is that in order to have green hydrogen, you have to have renewable energy production. So it's kind of a forcing function for different nations around the world to increase their renewable energy production, which can then go into production of hydrogen for their aviation sector or their transport sector.
Now, that's you raised a really interesting point there. Qualifying the color of hydrogen, so to speak, which is odorless and transparent and all the rest of it. But there is the terminology. There's green versus gray. That's an interesting one because hydrogen, we can't just say hydrogen, can we? Because we can't say, we're using hydrogen, therefore there is no environmental impact. Where does most hydrogen, if I'm just in the general market for some hydrogen, which I can't imagine that I am at this point, but where would I likely be getting it from now?
So it would be gray hydrogen, which means that it's produced via a reforming process, which has CO2 as an output of that process. So that's the reason why we really want to shift over to hydrogen, which is produced from electrolysis, where the electricity for the electrolyzer comes from a renewable source like wind or solar.
And that, again, looking to the countries that are like going to grow into this, that's very attractive as well. That means they can have a self-contained, they are more likely to be able to have a self-contained carbon economy, carbon-free economy from that point of view. Whereas currently the supply chains and how kerosene and so on are distributed, and clearly that's very anchored in certain countries and certain companies. So the higher degree of independence there from that point of view.
And there's always CO2 cost associated with transport of fuel. So if you can make your fuel on the site where you're going to use it, that is the way to really minimize your carbon footprint altogether.
So, that's a huge implication here. I mean, we were starting with the idea of here's a light aircraft, but actually the implications are quite staggering. So let's actually look, let's stagger out, because I think, okay, that's the air. Talk about land for a moment, because you were previously involved in Hyperloop. In the Hyperloop, and that is one area. I mean, clearly, there's cars and so on, and other forms of ground transport. Not everybody's going to take to the air to get from A to B. And in fact, some of the distances we're talking about, if we've got the means to do it by land, then sometimes we're going to favour that. So where do you see electricity in this, but also some of the more technologies that are pushing beyond the conventional? I mean, we're very familiar with Teslas and hybrids, but Hyperloop is clearly something different. What else is there in the pipeline or the loop line?
So, there is definitely a movement afoot to decarbonize and electrify ground-based transport. And so there is a reliance on batteries, which you can use, but batteries have a pretty big carbon output as well because of the rare mineral mining that goes into the batteries, and they have to be replaced and refurbished. So it's not like it has zero carbon output. And they're also sensitive to weight. So when you go to larger vehicles, like fleet vehicles, such as buses and trucks, they actually also will likely require hydrogen fuel cells for their power plant to be electric. So there's synergies between the aviation use case and large fleet vehicle use case, not to mention marine.
Yeah, okay, yeah, actually, let's take to water, because there's an interesting sort of picture here emerging. Exactly, there is a lot of synergy that improving in one sector kind of lightens the load. It improves acceptability, if nothing else, but certainly actually smooths the technology path and the idea of there is a hydrogen economy. So let's marine is really interesting because that's the one I think that people... It's a bit of a blind spot that actually most of the goods that we have, probably pretty much everything I'm wearing and holding and carrying and all the rest of it, ultimately most of that came to me by sea, and there's a huge cost to that. Clearly we can point to airplanes; they are obvious, but most of our goods. When we move away from the people to our goods and which form the basis, I guess, of much economy. There's a huge impact there, isn't there? The ocean is travel by ocean. I mean, I don't know how wasteful it is. I just know it is quite wasteful by comparison. So what can be happening there? Is that just a hydrogen thing? Are there other things that we can be doing there? Where is that going?
So hydrogen fuel cell power plant also works for boats, whether it is smaller boats or large container ships. So there's great synergy. And there's been a lot of, and I actually showed it in the talk, there's been a lot of work where governments in the EU have taken a look at where do you see synergies. And you see synergies in terms of the amount of payload you're trying to push and the amount of power which is required to push that payload between aviation and marine and large vehicles. So it is an important thing to focus on because I think it's popular to focus on going after people who are flying on international flights, but that isn't the source of the CO2 problem that we're facing. So it actually, from a transport perspective, marine is a big one, and we still have to provide goods and services to people. That can never go away. So it absolutely is a way to decarbonize the marine sector.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, as here we are in a pandemic, and although a number of things about our everyday life have changed and gone through various fault lines of their own, not least which is the number of flights that people are taking, actually people are still being supplied with goods.
Exactly.
And those goods are still being moved around the planet. That has not gone away.
Exactly. And from a go-to-market strategy, too, you know, getting it into a use case which would be faster to get the regulation approved for, such as marine, will only help, right? Because then it paves the way, economies of scale for other sectors, such as aviation.
Now, so that's kind of, so that's kind of taking us there. Let's talk a little bit about, it's just nudging into space, because one of the, I remember, so I have a book at home, again, one of those books I read as a kid that was telling me that here we are in 2021. I mean, it wasn't just moon bases, I was told. I was promised hypersonic craft in this book. It was, you know, it was going to be, you know, Concorde is just a stepping stone. We're going to be hypersonic within decades. We're going to be able to get from here to Australia rather than spending 24 hours traveling. It's just going to be a few hours, and it's just a nudge into the just nudge briefly out of the atmosphere and back in again. So where are we with that, and how does that fit with decarbonisation?
Well, I would say that it doesn't fit with decarbonization, but I think that suborbital vehicles are being developed for the purpose of sort of like space tourism, where you get come up really high, you see a view of the curvature of the Earth, and you come back down again. That could be used for something more than space tourism. It could be used for rapid transport. I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing, though, because of the carbon footprint associated with it. So, I mean, I think that's where regulation has to come in.
It's one of those areas. It's kind of like, you know, I was promised jetpacks and all the rest of it. And I kind of went, how does that fit in? That's a little bit outside what we're talking about. But in terms of everything that we're currently doing in the world, in terms of our transport and our movement of goods, that's all fair game for the kind of decarbonisation you're talking about. And what kind of, you know, in terms of transforming economies, but importantly, transforming flight. What kind of timeframes? I mean, obviously, I'm asking you to look into a crystal ball here. What kind of timeframes are we looking at? Because people, you know, the danger is we've been promised various things at various points. You know, I think I read another article about how close fusion is just last week. And again, that book that I've got told me it was before the end of the 20th century. And you know, there's that. So where, how far away does this feel? This feels very practical, what you're describing. You know, I don't expect the industry to change overnight, but what kind of time frames are we looking at here?
Well, I would say from an automotive perspective, we already have hydrogen fuel cell powered cars driving around on the road in the United States, and many gas stations actually have a hydrogen, compressed hydrogen supply, so you can actually fuel your car. It's probably not everywhere in the world, but certainly in the United States and probably in Germany. In terms of aircraft, I would say for small aircraft, it depends upon the weight of the aircraft. We'll see that within the next 5 years, obviously, with what we're doing in hydroplane. When it comes to larger aircraft, it's a little bit more of a challenge, both from a regulatory perspective and because you're typically, if you're carrying more passengers, you're going to go on a longer haul, you have to climb to a higher altitude. So that likely requires a change in the PEM fuel cell technology with a different type of electrolyte, just so they can operate at a higher temperature, as is necessary for higher compressor powers. And so that is probably more like the 10 to 15 year time frame out. And then for jet aircraft, you know, that's probably more like, you know, the 15 to 20 year time frame out.
So, so again, I'm going to come back to almost where we started, and then a couple of other closing thoughts. Airships, and I know this isn't necessarily your space, but it's so again, what I was promised in these books was helium airships, but they were a little bit kind of fuzzy about the power. They didn't mention that because they were just drawing pretty pictures, and this was for children. Is this the kind of thing that we keep seeing? On roughly once a decade, somebody predicts the comeback of the airship. Could hydrogen fuel cells, could this direction actually be one that could potentially bring them back, say, for, you know, haulage, if not passenger flight, at least cargo?
I'm not sure. I don't know too much about airships, and certainly that's maybe a slightly different use case. But I think the efficiencies of, you know, wing-borne flight generating aerodynamic lift from the wing is probably the most efficient from an energy perspective. So that's probably why I would say go for that, just because at the end of the day, when you're trying to be more energy efficient, you want everything about your system to design to be the most efficient possible. So I think that's where having wings allows you to achieve that, plus renewable energy to provide hydrogen through an electrochemical reaction with a fuel cell is kind of the holy grail solution to all that.
So speaking of winged flight, let's move to another planet. You were involved in Mars Curiosity, which is, I have to say, I don't know, can I have a favorite probe? I'm going to say I can have a favorite probe. It's one of my, I still have a favorite space station. Sorry, ISS, it's Mir. And Curiosity, I thought, was just such a classic mission. You worked on that. And entry, descent, landing sequence was part of what you did. And then we saw this year was such a good year for Mars. You know, United Arab Emirates to Mars, China to Mars. And NASA came back with, you know, as it were, the offspring of Curiosity, Perseverance, just, you know, sort of souped up, absolutely awesome. But it took with it Ingenuity, which as a programmer, I'm quite excited because I know that Perseverance and Curiosity was programmed in C. This was programmed in C++, and it meant that Linux arrived on Mars. So that's just a small side note there. But that was a proof of concept that you know, actually having a little helicopter on Mars, whose atmosphere is ridiculously almost nothing, and it worked, and it seemed to work incredibly successfully. Is that something that, you know, you're thinking that you know, looking ahead to the solar system, there's a few atmospheres around. You know, does this open something up, or is that just a dead end, a proof of concept? That was nice, but, you know, that was all we were going to ever do.
Well, I think it actually gets around a lot of the hazards of when you go to a planetary body where you don't have a lot of knowledge of what the surface terrain is like. Because if you're flying above it, you don't have to worry about driving over different rocks. You don't have to worry about the complexities associated with that. And you're able to travel longer distances and collect more scientific information. So I think it does lend itself to a variety of different scientific reconnaissance use cases. And there's Dragonfly, which is a mission which is coming up, which is a octocopter, which is the size of a small car, which is going to be flying around on Titan.
Yeah, Titan's a lot. Well, Titan's ridiculously cold, but it's got an atmosphere about as thick as Earth's.
Yes.
And it's also got, well, it's just above lunar gravity. So it's about a fifth of Earth's gravity. So you've got the atmospheric density, and you've got very little gravity. So yeah, you can carry a car around, but then there is a slightly different kind of, I guess, thermodynamic element there. But that could allow you sustained flight over quite some distance.
Yes. And you could also have an airplane on Mars as well, which has been proposed in the past but hasn't been done yet. So I think that would probably be the best way to cover large distances at the most energy efficient system design possible.
So speaking of large distances, let's go really large. Okay, so warp drive. No, I'm not going to ask you about, you know, the decarbonisation of warp travel. I do know that you're interested in Star Trek, so I do have, and as somebody who has an interest in that myself, they're not really into the whole flight thing except for space flight. But I have to ask you, okay, a couple of favourites questions. Do you have a favourite series? And do you have a favourite captain?
Yes. Star Trek Next Generation and Captain Picard.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, it's normally if you led with TNG, then it was going to be Picard. But if you led with Picard, it might not have been TNG.
I grew up on. So I did love Deep Space Nine as well, and I loved Voyager, and I loved the original series.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So yes, I have to admit that it was the original Star Trek. They were doing reruns when I was growing up. Plus they had the cartoon, and then they came out with the films, which, you know, they had some interesting stuff in the original films, but yeah, I have to say TNG kind of like partly cemented the deal, but does, I guess, to me, doesn't have quite the same quite the same meaning. So I'm a little more flighty with this, but I will say that Picard definitely. Yeah, okay. So we're going to bring this to a close now. Thank you very much for your attention. I hope that's been of interest. There's so much here that in terms of possibilities, and I think it really will be a case of watch the skies. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.